Hello and welcome to Baylor Connections, a conversation series with the people shaping our future. Each week we go in depth with Baylor leaders, professors, and more discussing important topics in higher education, research, and student life. I'm Derek Smith, and our guest today is Dr. Peter James. Dr. James serves as Assistant Professor of Planetary Physics at Baylor, where he founded the Planetary Research Group. Earlier in the summer, James received widespread attention for the discovery of mysterious massive material beneath the moon's largest crater. The study, which James led, was featured in outlets such as Scientific American, National Geographic, CBS News, and more. He specializes in the use of spacecraft data to study the crust and mantles of planets and moons in our solar system and has served on the science team of three NASA missions. He had a busy summer, a lot of widespread attention drawn to that study, and we're glad to have you here on the program today. Dr. James, welcome to Baylor Connections.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And, you know, there's something about when we talk about space and particularly something on the far side of the moon, something we didn't know was there. I think even if you're not a space person, it sparks a little something in you, stirs a little something in you when you hear that. As we dive into that, I want to ask you, you know, thinking back to where your interests began and where it led to you now, and, you know, we think of exploration and discovery when we think of space. How much did those ideals drive you into space research, and what's that moment of discovery like for you as an adult?
Well, calling it a moment of discovery might give the wrong impression. Mm-hmm. Sometimes scientific discoveries happen that way, where you have a eureka moment. But most of the time, science is more like journalism or litigation, where you spend years considering all the angles and building a case. Mm-hmm. So in our case, NASA collected the data about 7 years ago. Another few years went by before I noticed that something was weird about the moon's largest crater. And it took another few years to develop the right analytical approach.
Okay, well, let's dive into that. Now, I described your major finding, but it's better to hear it from you. How would you describe what your research team uncovered and discovered beneath the moon's largest crater?
Yeah, so the moon's largest crater is called the South Pole Aitken Basin. And basin is just a large word for a crater. Mm-hmm. And it's called the South Pole Aitken because it stretches roughly from the moon's south pole to a small crater on the far side of the moon called Aitken Crater. That's how you get the name South Pole
Aitken. I got you.
And to make a long story short, we used some measurements of the moon's gravity field to show that the moon's mantle probably has extra mass underneath this basin compared to other places inside the moon.
Visiting with Dr. Peter James, let's go inside the environment a little bit in which it exists. You just described what the South Pole Aitken Basin is, but how big is it? What characteristics about it stand out to you?
Well, it's like any old crater. It's just supersized. It's more than 1,000 miles wide, like from Mexico to Canada. It's elongated a little bit, so it's shaped more like an ellipse than a circle. And that tells us that the asteroid that impacted the moon to form this basin probably approached from a low angle. The impact should have excavated all the way through the moon's crust, so scientists are looking for evidence that pieces of the moon's mantle are sitting at the bottom of this basin, including a master's student in the geosciences department, Anna Reifer. As we speak, the Chinese Space Agency is operating a remote-controlled rover inside the South Pole Aitken Basin in search of pieces of the moon's mantle. And this isn't just about the moon. Earth was subjected to mega-size impacts in the past, but we've lost all trace of those cataclysmic events because of plate tectonics and erosion. But we can use a large basin like this one preserved on the moon as a natural laboratory of sorts, where we can compare computer simulations to what happens in real life. And that helps us understand the process that affected our own planet long before any of us were around.
We are visiting with Dr. Peter James, Assistant Professor of Planetary Physics at Baylor. You know, we talk about the far side of the moon. You talk about gathering data. What's that process like? I mean, how difficult is it? Is it like a pilot with instruments when you get the data, you know, having to kind of study a little bit things you can't always see? What's that like?
Well, until the space era, it was impossible to study the far side of the moon. The moon is tidally locked, meaning that the gravitational pull of the Earth keeps one side of the moon facing us at all times. And the South Pole Aitken Basin is on the far side of the moon, so we didn't know it even existed for a long time. In 1994, the DOD wanted to test some new satellite technology, so they teamed up with NASA to build a spacecraft called Clementine, and they put it in orbit around the moon. That had a LIDAR instrument that was able to measure the height of the spacecraft above the moon. And those data can be turned into a map of the topography. And that's what we were able to use to measure this huge, somewhat elongated depression several miles deep at the South Pole Aitken Basin. So even though we can't see it from Earth, that's how we know it's there.
Visiting with Dr. Peter James, and you know, you mentioned that the study that just uncovered this mysterious mass has been several years in the making. So what is the genesis of that study? What were you looking for, and how much overlap is there with what you were looking for and what you found?
Well, we were initially interested in making a map of how thick the moon's crust is. So the crust is the outermost layer of a planet or moon, and as I just mentioned, the basin-forming impact should have been powerful enough to strip away most of the crust inside the basin. We were using the gravity data to test that conventional wisdom, but what we found was that the data weren't very well explained by a shallow crust alone, and that there had to be something else going on in the deeper mantle.
Mm-hmm. So you described this a little bit. Let's go deeper into that. What's some of the data that you're looking at to determine what's down there? What are the numbers you're looking to understand better?
Yeah, this discovery comes from the moon's gravity field. And by that, I mean the very slight unevenness in the strength of gravity. If you were to jump, it's gravity that pulls you back down. But a lot of people don't realize that the strength of gravity changes depending on where you are. If the bedrock under your feet is exceptionally dense, the extra mass in the bedrock would pull you down to Earth quicker by a millisecond or so. So that's not enough to notice, but it is enough for precise instruments to detect. NASA recognized that this could be a valuable type of measurement to make. So 8 years ago, NASA launched the GRAIL mission, which consisted of a pair of spacecrafts orbiting in tandem around the moon. The spacecraft used a microwave beam to measure the relative velocity down to a micron per second, which still blows my mind, by the way. And from those measurements, we can calculate the moon's gravity field.
Visiting with Dr. Peter James. So when did you begin to recognize that there was an anomaly there? And once you did, what then?
Well, there was a long process of considering all the angles. One of the things I wanted to make sure we considered was whether or not it made sense for a mass anomaly like this to exist in the mantle. If you have something heavy embedded inside the moon's mantle, maybe you'd expect it just to sink down to the middle of the moon. So we did some viscous flow simulations for a variety of starting conditions and showed that, yes, it is possible for a mass this large to stay in the mantle indefinitely, provided that it was dispersed into small enough pieces like a buckshot. So we considered several angles like this before we were confident enough to publish the results.
How large is the mass?
It is a over 1,000. The mass, sorry.
Yes.
The mass, if you were to, I don't know, it's a number with a lot of zeros. And so, you know, when you're talking about numbers in the quadrillions, it's 2 quadrillion tons.
Wow.
Anything with the scale of space is generally difficult for us to comprehend. But the analogy I came up with was if you imagine a pile of metal roughly 5 times the size of the Big Island of Hawaii from the seafloor up to the summit.
Wow.
That's how much metal would make that big of a mass anomaly.
When you think about, you discover that's there, and we talk about it being hit. Are there any other explanations that you had to sift through, or was it obvious from the get-go as you uncovered this?
Well, there aren't a lot of alternatives based on, you know, just how enormous the mass anomaly is. One other that we considered was oxides in the mantle, like titanium oxide, titanium iron oxide is a mineral called ilmenite. And so it could be a concentration of that. But we like the impact hypothesis because we have a good explanation for why it should be there.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think when you talk about metal, people, you know, people picture what we think of as metal. When you're talking about metal in space, in the moon, what does that look like, or what does that feel like up there?
Well, there's lots of iron and nickel at the middle of almost every planet because that's the heaviest kind of material, and so usually it sinks down to the core of a planet. The asteroid that hit the moon was probably large enough to have its own core. So the asteroid that made the South Pole Aiken Basin would have been 100 miles wide or more. And that would have been large enough probably to have a bunch of iron accumulated at the center. And that's what we think is we're seeing here.
Visiting with Dr. Peter James. And Dr. James, so as all of this coalesces and you're ready to present this and you take it to, you know, to NASA and to other experts in the field, what's the reaction from them? What do they do with that information?
Well, this is something that astronauts can, or sorry, not astronauts, scientists can use to test models that they make. So there are people who do simulations of very large impacts, and that's nice to do on a computer, and it's hard to know whether it's right or not. And by having a real-world example of something that we simulate on a computer, it's a good way to test those computer models.
This is Baylor Connections. We are visiting with Dr. Peter James, Assistant Professor of Planetary Physics. He founded the Planetary Research Group here at Baylor. And, you know, if people were following Baylor on social media this summer, I'm sure they saw your work when it was released. And media coverage of this discovery really took off. You know, at the top of the show, we mentioned National Geographic, CBS News, and that's just a couple. Did you expect that sort of attention when you released this?
Sometimes it's hard to predict which stories will take off in the popular press. I co-authored a paper earlier this year in which we measured the amount of water hidden in the amount of water ice in craters near the North Pole of Mercury, and we didn't get any coverage about that. So, you know, sometimes maybe it helps when there's an air of mystery, like in the case of this moon mass anomaly. We don't know what it is, and that makes a good headline.
You know, from your standpoint, just in terms of even bringing attention to what you and your colleagues here at Baylor and elsewhere do, what does that media coverage mean? I mean, it's the kind of coverage and attention that if you paid for it, it would cost a lot. What does that mean to you all?
Well, there are a lot of ups and downs in academia. So Christians working in academia often need to take a step back and remember that professional success is not what defines your self-worth. And we're each an adopted child of God, and that's our identity above everything else. That's been a comforting thought for me when I have struggled in my career. And I think I inculcated that mindset so much that having media attention didn't really faze me one way or another.
Well, it certainly was. Those are good thoughts, and it was exciting to see that, though, that attention to what you and your colleagues did. Visiting with Dr. Peter James, and let's shift gears a little bit now. When you tell people that you're a professor of planetary geophysics, we're talking about lay people now, people you might meet at church or, you know, making new friends outside of the industry. How do people respond? Are there misconceptions, or you have to kind of explain what you do? What does that look like?
Most people smile and nod when I tell them I'm a planetary geophysicist, because that sounds very complex. And not that it isn't, but when you're in a hyper-specialized field, people tend to overuse terminology that sounds like Greek to everyone else. And planetary geophysics is basically the use of math to figure out what's inside a planet. There are plenty of smart people who have spent their careers building the mathematical tools needed to study planets. So it's a little easier to work in this field when you can stand on the shoulders of scientists who came before you.
What are, if there's someone listening interested in maybe someday doing what you do, what are some of the skills needed to do this? Well, obviously you mentioned math, but what's that look like?
Yeah, math is a very important skill for this field and so many other fields. And I would just encourage people to stick with math, because that's one of those subjects that a lot of people give up before they really reach their ceiling. And the longer you spend doing math, like maybe if you teach someone who's a grade lower than you, it will really help you really understand the concepts in a way that you didn't before. So I'd encourage people to, you know, keep at it, and your ceiling is higher than you think.
What are the when you think of the calculations you do or the math skills you use? What are the staples? What are the basic building blocks of what you do most regularly, math wise?
There is calculus, linear algebra, and differential equations. Those are three of the pillars of not just this field, but so many other fields.
Sure.
And those are, yeah, just different tools for solving different kinds of problems. And you'd be surprised how many different problems boil down to one of those three areas, calculus, mm-hmm. linear algebra, or differential equations.
Visiting with Dr. Peter James. And Dr. James, you founded the Planetary Research Group here at Baylor. And we want to talk about that. But first, I want to start on the website. And you visitors find prominently a quote by C.S. Lewis, "Aim for heaven, and you will get the earth thrown in." What does that phrase mean to you, and how has it influenced you as a scientist?
I love that quote because it has a double meaning for us. C.S. Lewis meant it in the theological sense. You know, if you have a kingdom mindset and focus on heaven, that affects your priorities on earth in a good way. In a planetary sense, we study other planets in order to better understand how our own planet works. One of our PhD students, Rudger Dame, is studying Venus, a planet that's similar to Earth in many ways. It has the same size, it's made of the same kind of rocks, and yet it's a completely different planet. 800 degrees, it rains sulfuric acid, and instead of plate tectonics, it has something called a stagnant lid with a lot of volcanoes. Understanding what makes Venus the way it is will help us better understand why Earth works the way it does. Another one of our PhD students, Nick Wagner, is studying volcanoes on Mars, which are huge, taller, and wider than anything we see on Earth. And the same kinds of techniques that we use to study other planets, we can apply to Earth. And that's what some of the master's students in our department are doing. One's studying a crater in Arizona, and another's using gravity measurements to study the Brazos River aquifer. Aim for heaven, and you'll get Earth thrown in. Studying planets in space can have real down-to-Earth benefits.
Mm-hmm. That's very cool. And you talk about your faith earlier, and you know, people talk sometimes about faith and science, and there's some people out there who don't see where those streams come together. But for you as a scientist and a man of faith, what impact does one have on the other for you in the work you do?
Well, there's a long history of major discoveries in science happening by people of faith. Not that you can't solve an equation if you don't believe in God, but it does give a sense of wonder that has inspired me to go into something like planetary geophysics. I'm excited to try to discover things about the universe and about creation that no one else has seen before.
You are one faculty member in the Planetary Research Group. There's some fantastic faculty that are a part of that. What is that collaboration look like in the work you do? And then more broadly, what does space research look like here at Baylor beyond what we've been discussing?
Well, collaboration comes from unexpected places sometimes. I was on a retreat in August hosted by the Institute of Faith and Learning, and random conversation on the bus led to an idea to invent a new instrument that could be used on spacecraft someday. And we've already submitted the first proposal to NASA to design it, so we'll see where that goes. Baylor has some really talented geologists, engineers, and physicists, and it's turned out to be a great environment for innovation.
More broadly, where are we at in space research, nationally and internationally? Because I think sometimes, you know, with changes in NASA over the last 10, 15 years, sometimes a lot of attention's been paid to what's not being done. But what is being done? Where are we right now?
NASA currently has a mandate from the White House to return humans to the moon by 2024. So NASA is revving up with the development of a lunar space station called Lunar Gateway, and with the Space Launch System at Johnson Space Center and commercial partners like SpaceX here in McGregor, they're getting involved in a big way too. 2024 might turn out to be an ambitious target, but if we accomplish anything close to our current aspirations, you're going to start hearing a lot more about the moon's south pole, because that's where the next moonwalkers are headed.
Oh, wow. So someone will see what you said, where no one has gone before in, mm-hmm. in this situation. As we visit with Dr. Peter James, heading into the final moments of the program, you have collaborated, as we mentioned, on three NASA missions. One of those collaborations is a study of the planet Mercury's crust. What do you hope to learn from this study?
Mercury is pretty unique. Its core is almost as large as the planet itself, and we're still trying to figure out what the crust is made of. I'm working with some engineers at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center to track the spacecraft orbit, or to use the tracking data in the past from the Messenger spacecraft. It's not orbiting anymore. But that was the first orbiter around Mercury, and so we're getting a lot of information about the gravity field there. And what we want to do is see if we can figure out how dense the rocks are and use that to figure out what kinds of rocks they might be. Even though Mercury's unique in our own solar system, there could be many planets like Mercury orbiting around other stars, what we call exoplanets. We want to understand the full diversity of rocky planets that might exist in our galaxy, whether they're more like Mercury or Venus or Earth or Mars.
Talking to Dr. Peter James, and as we look ahead to your future research endeavors, what are the driving questions that you find most compelling, or their projects that are high on your list of things to do in the years ahead?
Well, there's a big universe to discover, and we haven't even scratched the surface. In order to learn more about the mass anomaly that we've been discussing, we need new types of scientific measurements, because you can only go so far with one coming from one angle, like looking at the gravity field of the planet. So we can learn more by deploying seismometers on the moon. We know that there are moonquakes, and the Apollo astronauts detected those when they were on the moon. So you can use moonquakes and how they travel through the moon to study what's inside the moon better. Magnetometers measure the magnetic field. And another thing that we can do is very precisely measure the moon's tidal deformation. So as the moon goes through the course of a month, the tidal forces from the Earth and Sun change, and the whole solid moon itself flexes. And you can look at how much it's flexing to study what's deep inside the moon. And so those are different kinds of scientific measurements that we can make to study what's inside the moon. Those are all things that we know how to do, so we're looking forward to a new generation of discoveries in space.
Well, that sounds very exciting, and we'll look forward to that. And Dr. James, congratulations on a big summer. It's exciting to see that research come out, and as you mentioned, the attention that has come to this was certainly good. I know it's been a big summer. We'll look forward to more of that ahead. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Peter James, Assistant Professor of Planetary Physics at Baylor, our guest today on Baylor Connections. I'm Derek Smith. A reminder, you can hear this and other programs online, baylor.edu/connections. Thanks for joining us here on Baylor Connections.